Chapter 17. Operation Hieronymo. I believe this gaunt fellow is singularly overrated. General Notches Sturm to Major Gilbert, during the assault on Voltimand. A scratch company met them at 281KL to guide them in. The company was 40 strong and had been conducting guerrilla work in the southern outer Habs before the shield fell. Their leader, a powerful saturnine ex-miner called Gol Collier, saluted Gaunt as he approached. Gaunt looked every centimetre a leader, though the braid of his cap had been rubbed with ash to dull its glint. He wore the power sword at his waist and his bolt gun in a holster across his chest under a short black leather jacket. On top of that, draped expertly as Colm Corbeck had instructed him during the first days of the Ghost Regiment's existence, was his Tanith stealth cape. The roar of battle thundered down the ruined streets beside them. But this sector was clear and quiet. Cold morning light filtered in through the crackling shield. Gaunt signaled his units up to join Collier's scratch company. 30 men, all Tanith, pale-skinned, dark-haired warriors in black fatigues and stealth capes, their skin decorated with various blue tattoo symbols. They were the cream of Rawn's unit and the pride of McColl's stealth scouts. Amongst them, Bragg, Larkin, Domor, McVenna, Dremond, Genks, Nescon, Kokoa, the medic Geren, most of the very best. Gaunt was beginning to outline Operation Hieronymo to his waiting squad when Rawn heard movement down a side street. The ghosts and scratches fanned out and made ready, arming weapons freshly supplied for the mission. A fire team of 10 Volponi advanced down the side street, led by Colonel Gilbert. They were all Volponi elite troops from the 10th, massive carapace-armored and holding hell guns ready. Gaunt walked out into the rubble-strewn open to meet Gilbert. They saluted each other.
"Not going in without the blue bloods, I hope, Colonel Commissar," Gilbert said archly.
"I wouldn't dream of it, Colonel," Gaunt replied. "I'm glad you got my message, and gladder still you found your way here. Join us. We're about to move out."
Gaunt crossed to Rawn and Collier as the Volponi meshed into the column spread.
"I don't fething believe you invited them," Rawn cursed.
"Keep your thoughts to yourself, Major. The Blue Bloods may be bastards, but I feel I have reached an understanding with them. Besides, we'll need their muscle when it comes to it." Rawn spat in the puddles and made no reply.
"I understand your command now," Collier said bluntly to Gaunt. "May I ask what the gack you're doing here? Nide and Crow never got their hands dirty."
"Their command ethic was different, Collier. I hope you'll appreciate my method of doing things."
"Can you sign?"
"What?"
"Most of my company are deaf. Can you sign your commands?"
"I can, sir," McColl piped up. Gaunt gestured to the scout sergeant. "McColl can relay my instructions to your fighters. Good enough?" Gol Collier scratched his cheek.
"Perhaps."
Gaunt could tell Collier had been through hell in the last 30-odd days. Courage and determination seemed to ooze out of him like sweat. He was not a man Gaunt wanted to be on the wrong side of. They followed dingy, battle-worn streets out through the southern extremities of the hive, and they left the shattered curtain wall behind them. McColl's scouts led the way, directed by Collier's troops. The bulky Volponi struggled to keep up with the swift, silent advance. Clear of the shield, they were all exposed to the bitter rain.
"You know these quarters well, Collier. I guess they were your home," Gaunt remarked softly to the miner.
"Correct. Just half a kilometer from here, I could take you to the crater where my hab once stood."
"You lost family?"
"A wife, 2 children. I don't know they're dead, but gach, what are the chances?"
Gaunt shrugged.
"How many did you lose coming here?"
Collier asked.
"Troops." Collier shook his head.
"Family.
I didn't have any to lose. I don't know which of us is luckier."
Collier smiled, but without any light or laughter in his face.
"Neither one, Commissar. And that's the tragedy." "I don't know about the girls,"
Larkin muttered as they moved through the scorched-out, rain-pelted ruins. Bragg, his missile launcher and autocannon slung over his shoulders, raised his eyebrows and made no reply. There were 8 females in Collier's scratch company, none older than 25.
Each held a captured Zeuchen lasgun or a Verven primary auto rifle and carried an equipment pack over their ragged work fatigues. Most of them, like the men, wore salvaged military boots wadded with socks and wrapped tight with puttees made of cargo tape to keep them fast. The women moved as silently and as surely as their male comrades. A month of intense guerrilla war in the outhabs had trained them well. Those that had not learned had not made it.
"Women can fight,"
Rilke murmured, holding his sniper rifle with the stock high in his armpit and the long barrel pointing downwards.
"My sister Laurel used to hold her own against the rowdies when it got to chucking out time in my father's tavern back home. Faith, but she could throw a punch."
"That's not what I meant,"
growled Larkin, rain dripping off his thin nose.
"It doesn't seem right, sending women in like this, all gussied up in combat gear and weaving lasguns. I mean, they're just girls. This is going to get nasty. No place for women."
"Keep it down,"
Drummond hissed, lugging his flamer with its weighty, refilled tanks.
"They'll hear you, Lax."
"You heard what that big bastard miner said. They're all shell deaf. I can speak my mind without insulting no one. They can't hear me."
"But we can read lips, Tanith,"
Banda said, moving past the chief sniper with a smirk. Some of the other scratches nearby laughed.
I didn't mean nothing by it,"
Larkin began, moving his mouth over emphatically to make sure she could hear. Banda looked back at him, a mocking expression on her dirty face.
"And anyway, I'm not deaf. Neither's Muriel, and neither are the Zeukens. So why don't you clamp it and do us all a favor?"
They moved on, the 80-strong assault group splashing down a damp, debris-strewn side road.
"That told you,"
Drummond whispered to Larkin.
"Shut up,"
Larkin replied. McVenna scouted ahead as part of McColl's recon deployment. In his immediate field of vision was Scout Bonin and the Scratch Company guides. A girl called Nessa and a Verven primary sergeant named Haller, who was second in command of Collier's makeshift group. Haller was one of nine Verven primary survivors to have found their way into the Scratch Company, though with his dirty, patched uniform and the woolen cap he wore in place of his spiked helmet, he didn't look much like a primary infantryman anymore. He seemed content to be commanded by a miner rather than a military officer. McVenna knew the members of the Scratch Company had weathered the very worst of the war, and he couldn't begin to understand their loyalties or the circumstances that had brought them together. Nessa guided them through a series of torched manufactories, covering the ground quickly, keeping low and making curt, direct gestures they could read easily. They crossed an arterial highway where the rockcrete was crumpled by a series of shell holes, and they skirted the wrecks of two Zeuchen battle tanks and an infantry carrier that had been flipped over onto its back. Across the highway, they fanned through textile mills where the constant rain trickled in through the holed roofs and rows of iron-framed looms stood silent and shattered. The loose ends from hundreds of bales of twine rippled in the breeze. McVenna stopped in a doorway and scanned around. He watched with idle fascination as droplets of rainwater crept down taut feed threads over one loom, glinting like diamonds and thickening before dripping off the hanging brass bobbin onto the weaving frames beneath. McVenna realized he'd lost sight of the woman. Haller appeared behind him.
"You have to watch her,"
Haller mouthed, signing at the same time. He knew full well McVenna could hear, but the practice was now instinctive. Bonin joined them, and they edged down the length of the mill until they found Nessa in an open loading dock at the far end, crouched behind an overturned bale lifter. Outside, in the bright thin light of the cargo yard, a quintet of Zeuchen flamer tanks grumbled by, heading north. The foot soldiers could smell the coarse stench of the promethium lapping in the tank's heavy bowsers. Once the tanks had passed, Nessa made a punching motion in the air, and the troops hurried on, across the open yard and into the razor-wire-edged enclosure of a guild's freight haulage plant. The rusting bulks of overhead cranes and hoists creaked in the wind above them. Rainwater had formed wide, shallow lakes across the rock-crete apron. They moved past rows of plasteel cargo crates and produce hoppers flaking paint. Near the haulage site office, a small imperial chapel built for the workers had been desecrated by the advancing Zeukens. They'd shot out the windows and soiled the walls with excrement. A dozen site workers had been crucified along the front porch on gibbets made from rail sleepers. The bodies were little more than ghastly, stringy carcasses now. They'd been nailed up 3 weeks before, and the steady rain and the carrion birds had done their best to erode the flesh. Haller's boot clipped an empty bottle, and the noise of it tinkling away across the ground startled the birds, who rose in cawing, raucous mobs, revealing the grisly horrors beneath. Some of the birds were fat, glossy black scavengers, the others dirty white seabirds from the estuary with clacking pincer bills. Black and white, the birds made a brief checker pattern in the air before flocking west to the haulage barn roof and settling. The open ground was peppered and sticky with their droppings. There was a break in the fence behind the chapel. McVenner held position long enough to check, via microbead, that the main force was within range behind them. Gaunt and the column were just entering the haulage site. The land south of the freight holding was a mass of chalky rubble and sprouting weeds. There were dark driver holes in the ground at intervals, and the area was littered with thousands of gleaming brass shell cases. In an earlier stage of the war, massive Zeuchen field pieces had been braced here, trained at the wall. McVenner was about to move on, but Nessa stopped him. He made the gesture for question, and she signed and mouthed back at him.
In our experience, the Zeuchens trap wire their sights when they move on.
McVenner nodded. He signaled back, and Gaunt sent Domor forward. Haller helped Domor lock his sweeper set together, and then the ghost began to creep away from them, playing the head of the broom back and forth over the dirt. Domor liked to do this work by sound, and McVenner smiled to see him closing the shutters of his bionic ocular implants by hand. The time when Domor could simply close his eyelids was long past, way back on Menazoid Epsilon. Domor had a path cleared in under 5 minutes, playing out a fiber cord to mark its zigzag path. By the time he had finished, the assault force had caught up with them and were waiting with McVenner, Haller, Nessa, and Bonin at the fence.
"He found nothing?"
asked Haller, pointing over at Domor on the far side of the area.
"No, he found plenty, but we're not here to mine lift. Follow the cord," replied McVenner.
Single file, the 80 soldiers crossed the ex-artillery emplacement and moved down along a reinforced walkway that crossed one of the hive's main drainage gullies. Swollen by the heavy rains, the gully was in full flood. It was partially dammed in places by sloughs of debris rubbish and bundles of corpses. Up the other side, they climbed the chute slope by a metal stairway and hurried in small packs across another highway. The ruined remains of bodies littering the road stretched as far as the eye could see. Most tried not to look. Larkin stared in horrified fascination as he crossed the road. Nothing more than bundles of rags, the bodies, were those of workers and habbers slaughtered as they had tried to flee inwards towards Vervenhive. They had fallen weeks before, and no one had touched or moved them except the mashing tracks of Zeuchen war machines heading north towards their target. Gaunt called a halt period in the broken habitats on the far side of the highway. His motley brigade set up defense watches all around as he climbed to the third story of a hab block with Collier and Gilbert.
"I smell smoke,"
Gilbert said suddenly. He moved ahead, down the dirty, dank hallway, his weapon raised, and kicked open the rotting door of a worker flat. Gaunt and Collier, weapons ready, moved in behind him. All three stopped short. The flat was thick with trash and overrun with vermin. The smoke issued from a small fire set in a tar bucket over which swung a metal pot on a wire frame that had once been a clothes hanger. The five inhabitants of the room, a mother with three children and a much older woman, cowered in the far corner. They were emaciated and filthy, just terrified skin and bone, clad in dirty tatters. The old woman whined like a caged animal, and two of the children cried silently. The mother, her eyes bright and fierce in her soot-black face, held at a shank of metal, sharpened to a point. "Back off, now," Gaunt told Collier and Gilbert, though Collier needed no urging. "It's all right. I'm sorry," Gaunt told the mother, his hands raised, open. The shank remained pointing at him.
"Leave them,"
Collier said. He pulled a wad of ration cakes from his pack and went over, dropping them on the floor in front of the group when the mother refused to take them. They went back out into the hallway, and Collier pulled the door back into place.
"Throne of Earth,"
Gaunt hissed, shaking his head.
"Quite," joined Gilbert. "What a waste of rations."
Gaunt looked round at him, began to speak, and then just shook his head. Explaining the real nature of his horror to Gilbert might take a lifetime. And that time, however it could be measured, was all Gaunt had left to do something far more important than drum compassion into an aristocratic warrior like the blue-blood colonel. Collier had heard Gilbert's remark, and he glowered at the man with utter disdain. Collier doubted even the Colonel Commissar understood what it was like to claw and scrape for survival in the shelled ruins of your home day after day. Gull Collier had seen enough of that misery since the Zoikens came, enough to last 100 lifetimes. There were thousands of Hab families out here still, slowly dying from starvation, disease, and cold. The trio of officers climbed out onto a fire escape at the eastern end of the Hab block, and Gaunt and Gilbert pulled out their scopes. 5 kilometers south, across the ruins, through the smoke and rain, rose the bulk of the spike. It was moving at a slow crawl up towards the main hive. Gaunt swung his scope around and looked back at the vast, glinting dome of the shield and the massive spine and Hab structures within. Gaunt offered his scope to Collier, but the man wasn't interested. Gilbert gestured suddenly and sharply to them both and pointed down at the highway below, the one they had just crossed. A host of Zoikan troopers, escorted by a vanguard of carriers and light tanks, was advancing towards them. Chaos banners flopped lankly in the rain, and the light shone off the wet, ochre-coloured armor. Gilbert raised his Hellgun, about to turn, but Gaunt stopped him. "We're not here to fight them. Our fight is elsewhere." The Commissar keyed his microbead. "Mass enemy formation approaching along the highway outside. Stay low and stay silent." Rawn voxed back an acknowledgement. It took half an hour for the Zoikan column to go by. Gaunt estimated that there was a little over 2,000 foot troops and 60 armored vehicles, reserves, advancing to bolster the assault. He wished to the Emperor himself he had reserves of such numbers to call upon. Feth, he wished he had such strengths in his active units. Once the column was safely passed and clear, the Operation Hieronymo assault cadre left the habitats and moved on through rain-swilled ruins towards the spike. The closer they got, the bigger it grew, dwarfing all the building structures around. Larkin bit back deep unease. It was big. So fething big. How in the name of Feth were 80 souls going to take on a thing that size? They were cowering in rubble. Larkin raised his head and saw Banda grinning back at him. "Scared yet, Tenith?" she hissed. Larkin shook his head and looked away. McColl, McVenna, and Gaunt moved forward with Collier, Rawn, and Haller in a line behind them. Now they could hear the throbbing grind of the spike's enormous track sections, the deep growl of its engines. Gaunt noticed dust and ash trickling down the rubble around him in sharp, rhythmic blurts. He realized the vast machine, still a kilometer distant, was vibrating the earth itself with its weight and motivation. The rain grew suddenly heavier. An incessant patter filled the air around them, accompanied by a regular tinking chime. It came from a broken bottle, wedged in a spill of bricks, sounding every time a raindrop hit its broken neck. Gaunt wiped water droplets from the end of his scope and studied the spike.
"How do we do this?" he asked McColl.
McColl frowned.
"From above. Let's get ahead and find a suitable habitat overlook, unless it changes course."
Gaunt took the group across the wide, pulverized trail behind the advancing spike, a half-kilometer strip of soil and ash compressed by the vehicle's weight into glinting carbon. The spike didn't steer around buildings. It flattened them, making its own path. The Imperial Strike Force overtook the great war machine on the right flank and pressed ahead, hugging the ruins and the rubble. McColl indicated a pair of worker Hab blocks ahead of them that promised to intersect the spike's course. Gaunt detailed his troopers into 2 units and sent one ahead under Gilbert, leading the other himself. Gaunt's troop were climbing up the stairwell of the nearer Hab, 500 paces ahead of the crawling target, when the spike fired again. Its awesome spinal weapon, the cutting beams, howled vast energies above and past them at some target in the main hive. The sound was louder than their ears could manage. The Hab shuddered thoroughly, and a harsh light flash penetrated every crevice and opening in the stairwell for a moment. A second later, there was a pop of pressure, a wall of dissipating heat, and the stink of plasma. Gaunt and his troop exchanged glances. It had been like standing too near a star for a millisecond. Their eyes ached, and the energized stench burned their sinuses. Gaunt wiped a thread of blood from his lip. There was no time to waste, however. Gaunt and McColl led the party up to the 5th floor, to the flats at the far end. The spike was almost on them. Half a dozen ragged habbers fled past them, running like beaten dogs from their hideaways. Gaunt got a signal from Gilbert in the other block. The second unit was in position. He looked out of the end window, glassless and burned, and saw how close the massive machine now was. Its lower slopes swiped the edge of the hab block and tore it away, rubble cascading down under the tracks. Gaunt moved his soldiers back as the passing armor wall tore the end off the room they waited in. Then they moved. In pairs and trios, they leapt clear of the ripped-open building and dropped 7 meters onto the sloping sides of the spike. Most slid down the ochre-painted hull before managing to cling fast to molding projections, rivets or weld seams. Gaunt landed hard, slid for a moment, then braced against a row of cold-punched bolt-heads. He heard a cry from above and looked up to see Larkin slithering down the armored slope, his hands clawing uselessly at the tarnished metal. Gaunt snagged the sniper by his stealth cape and arrested his slide, nearly throttling him with a taut fabric. Larkin found purchase and crawled up beside Gaunt.
"Saving my ass again, Ibram," Larkin stammered in relief.
Gaunt grinned. At a time like this, he hardly minded Mad Larkin's informality.
"You're welcome. It's my job."
10 meters down the spike's side, Haller also lost his grip. He slid, barking out a helpless curse, and slammed into Dremond, who was barely holding on himself. The two of them tore away and started to slide much more swiftly down the flank, thrashing for handholds. Bragg drew his Tanith blade, punched it into the spike's plating to provide a firm anchor point, and caught them as they tumbled past. He captured Dremond by the harness of his flamer, and Dremond held tight to Haller. By then, they had barreled into Muriel, one of the Scratch Company loom girls, too, and Haller held on to her. Secured by one meaty fist around the hilt of his knife, Bragg supported 3 dangling humans.
"Firth,"
he grunted, his arm shaking under the weight.
"Get a grip. I can't hold on much longer."
Muriel swung around and grabbed the edge of an armor plate, digging her fingertips into the seam. As soon as she was secure, Haller let go and slid down beside her. Bragg heaved the kicking Dremond up next to him by the man's flamer straps.
"Good fething catch,"
Dremond gasped, gripping tightly, trying to slow his anxious breathing.
"I don't always miss,"
replied Bragg. He didn't dare voice his relief. For a moment, he had been close to dropping them, or being pulled away with them. Gaunt's unit, 40 bodies, clung to the sloping side of the gigantic Zeuchen war machine and slowly began to climb up it. The spike's pyramid form was punctuated by shelf-like terraces, like some step temples of antiquity Gaunt had once seen on Ficus Dolorous. The soldiers crawled up over the lip and made themselves fast on the nearest horizontal shelf. The progressing spike, oblivious to the human lice now adhering to its hide, moved on and slammed over and through the hab block where Gilbert's team was waiting. Gaunt watched in horror as the metal slopes demolished a large chunk of the hab's lower stories. Then he saw Gilbert and his team leaping down from a far higher level. They'd clearly moved up a floor or two when the impact of the spike's course had become evident. The troopers, led by Gilbert, dropped far further than Gaunt's unit had done. They impacted on the hull above the shelf Gaunt and the others occupied, and most slid down onto that safe landing. Some clung on to where they found purchase on the slopes above. 2, a Volpone and the Tanith scout Bonin, bounced away like rocks down a mountainside and dropped past Gaunt, disappearing 100 meters below under the lip of the hull. Gaunt looked away. If the sheer fall hadn't killed them outright, they were dead under the massive caterpillar carriage. Gaunt signaled around and made contact with the remaining troopers. They were all rendezvousing on the shelf lip. The curtain wall of Vervenhive was now only minutes away, and their time was disappearing fast. Weapons ready, reaching out hands to steady themselves against the motion of the spike, the strike team followed Gaunt down the shelf. The difficult part remained, how to find a way inside this armored monster. The hull was solid. Domor pulled out the head of his sweeper kit and pressed it against the throbbing metal.
"Dense. No cavities," he growled disappointedly.
Gaunt sighed. They could blast or cut the hull open if there was a chance of accessing a hollow space within. But Domor was positive. It stood to reason a machine like this would be thick-skinned. 2 of Gilbert's Volpone returned along the shelf from scouting the far end. Gilbert heard their reports and edged along to Gaunt.
"The main weapon ports along the forward face. They're open, ready for firing. It's that or nothing."
"And if they fire while we're entering?"
"Then we're dead. You want to stay out here for the rest of the war?"
Gaunt barked out a laugh at Gilbert's attitude. No, I guess we won't know anything about it if they fire.
It'll be quick, certainly,
Gilbert agreed. Gaunt notified the squad leaders and led the single-file team along the shelf. They were about to make the turn onto the forward face when the beam weapons fired again. The light flash was even more brutal out in the open, and the sucking roar monstrous. The whole spike shook.
How long since the last salvo?
Gaunt asked Larkin as soon as his ears stopped ringing.
8 minutes, just about, boss.
I'm working with the idea it takes a while for the batteries to recharge. We've got 8 minutes to get inside.
That sounds so easy when you put it like that, snarled Rawn.
Shouldn't we be moving, rather than debating?
Collier asked, shaming them all. Gaunt nodded. Yes. Now, go!
Always, always lead from the front. Never expect a man under your command to undertake an action you're not prepared to make yourself.
It was one of Delane Oktar's primary rules, drummed into Gaunt during his years with the Hyrkans. He was not about to forget his mentor's advice now. Gaunt led the way around the corner of the hull and hurried towards the huge main weapon recesses below him. Visor hatches the size of the Sondar gates were pulled up from the port like eyelids. The air was sweet and tangy with burnt plasma and fluorocarbons. Gaunt reached the edge of the emplacement recess and grabbed hold of one of the shutter stanchions, a heavyweight hydraulic limb at full extension. His leather glove slid off the oiled, shining metal. He pulled the glove off and took hold with his bare hand, arming his bolt gun in the other. Gaunt leapt and let himself fall, swinging down and around like an ape by one hand. Using his body weight's pendulum momentum, he threw himself in through the weapon hatch, letting go of the hydraulic limb at the same moment. He fell, rather than jumped, inside the hull, landing and stumbling on a grilled cageway that ran alongside the massive snouts of the beam cannons. Rolling, he saw two black-clad Zoikan gunners leap up from their firing consoles, and he shot them down. Three Zoikan soldiers in full battle dress charged up onto the cageway, blasting at him. Gaunt lost his footing and fell, the last shot screaming over his head. The shots blew apart the torso of the Volpone leaping in behind him and threw his corpse back and outwards so it fell away down the slope of the hull. Recovering, Gaunt resumed firing, aiming precise headshots at the Zoikans, exploding their full-face helmets with high-explosive rounds. Then, Gilbert, McColl, and three other Tanith had made it inside behind him. McColl opened up with his las rifle, supporting Gaunt's fire pattern, and Gilbert turned back to pull others of the strike force in through the huge awning. Gaunt and McColl advanced with Kroth and Rilke, partly to secure the weapon deck and partly to make room. The Commissar and his three Tanith troopers scoured the gun control position, blasting dozens of Zoikan personnel. Within moments, the Zoikan troopers set up a flaying return of fire. Kroth was blasted off his feet, and McColl took a hit to his hip. He slammed back into the wall and fell, but somehow maintained his fire rate. Now Gilbert and three of his elite blue blood were coming in behind, laying down a field of fire with their hell guns. Behind them, on the cageway, Haller and Collier were dragging the other squad members in through the hatch. Gilbert's fireteam advanced and secured the gunnery deck behind the colossal beam emitters, slaying everything that moved. The air in the chamber was dense and rich with gunsmoke. The grilled deck was strewn with Zoikan dead. Somewhere, an alarm began to wail. Inside 4 minutes, Gaunt's strike team had entered the spike via the gunports, all 78 of them. Three had died in the initial engagement. Gaunt checked on McColl. His wound was superficial, and he was already back on his feet. The strike force spread out to cover all the exit ways on the gloomy gun deck. He led the way to a main blast door that gave access to the spike's inner cavities. It was locked fast.
I can blow it,
said Collier at his side. Gaunt drew the power sword of Hieronymo Sondar, activated it, and sliced the incandescent blade through the hatch. A further three sweeps and a kick left the hatchway open, the cut section of metal clanging as it fell on the deck outside.
Move! Cried Gaunt. Move!
The spike's main weapon deck was linked to the primary command sections by a long, sloping access way, wide enough for a Lehman Russ to drive along it. It was painted matte red, the color of meat, and thick bulkhead frames stood at every 20 meters. The floor was a metal grill, and in the underfloor cavity, pipes, tubing, and feeder cables could be seen. Off to either side, just on the other side of the blast door, stood service elevators with metal cage frames set in circular loading docks. The elevators were heavy-duty freight lifts designed to haul shells from the munition stockpiles deep in the belly of the spike up to the artillery blisters on the upper slopes.
The metal walls of the access way were covered with intricate emblems, the curious, nauseating runes of chaos. Gaunt realized that they had been fashioned from bone that had been inlaid into the metal and then polished flat with the wall so they glowed and shone like pearl. Human bone, he guessed. The Heritor would demand such details. A team of Zoikan heavy troopers in segmented ochre body armor greeted them in the accessway as they entered, firing up the slope tunnel from cover at the far end. One of the scratches, a man whose name Gaunt would never know, was sliced apart by the initial shots. His blood sprayed the bone icons on the wall, and the symbols began to squirm and shift. Larkin saw this and fell back in horror, his guts churning. The eldritch symbols were alive, excited by blood. He knew he was about to vomit with fear.
"Taking a breather?"
Banda asked sourly as she pushed past him, firing down at the enemy position. The Imperials were hugging the walls and using the bulkheads for cover, edging down the access way as far as the enemy fire would allow.
"A breather?"
Larkin gulped. He was incredulous. No smirking girl from the Hablooms would show him up. Forgetting his fear, he knelt in cover, shook out his neck, raised his sniper variant las rifle, and put a hot shot between the eyes of a Zoikan heavy 20 paces away.
"Nice work,"
Banda growled from her position, and blew Larkin a cocky kiss. Larkin grinned and made another kill shot. Either he was beginning to like this woman, or he'd kill her himself. Another of the scratches fell, ripped open by the mauling heavy weapons the enemy had trained on them. They were caught too tightly between the hall and the entry point Gaunt had cut open. His men fanned round into the side loading docks, but they were packed in. Rawn hurled a tube charge down the tunnel, but the Zoikans had enough cover to shelter from it.
"Drummond!"
Gaunt yelled. The flamer trooper was still trying to pull his bulky tanks through the narrow opening Gaunt's power sword had sliced. Las rounds peppered the metal around him. A ghost nearby, Lonna, collapsed with the back of his neck blown out. Drummond was clear. Gaunt and Collier physically dragged the big ghost to the front of the line, and Drummond braced his scorched flame gun, ensuring the feed pipe wasn't twisted and the igniter was sparking. He squeezed the trigger grip, and billows of white-hot flame sheeted down the tunnel, incinerating the Zoikan heavies. The scourging flame bubbled the paint off the walls, and the twitching bone runes began to shriek. He washed the hall with another gout, to be sure, and then Rawn, Haller, and Bragg led off to secure the hall. Bragg reached the position the enemy had been holding, and he stepped over the black fused corpses. There was another access way to his left, and he sprayed bursts of autogun fire through the door mouth. Haller moved to the right and went over hard as a half-burned Zoikan soldier threw himself at the scratch officer. The blackened thing, its ceramite armor part melted into its flesh by Dremon's flames, tore at him in a frenzy. Haller screamed out, frantic. Rawn grabbed the Zoikan and threw it off Haller. It bounced off a wall, and before it could rise, Rawn had shot it 4 times with his las gun.
"I owe you, ghost," said Haller, getting up.
"No, you don't, Haber. I don't like it when anyone owes me anything. Forget it."
Haller paused, as if slapped in the face. He hadn't much liked the look of the Tanith Major when they had all first assembled. Banda had whispered Rawn had toxic eyes. It seemed true. Even the haughty Volpone seemed to be making more of an effort to be comradely than this Tanith bastard.
"Suit yourself," Haller said.
"He always does," mocked Bragg. The big ghost knew it was neither the time nor the place to bring Haller up to speed on Rawn's history. The fact that Rawn hated Gaunt with an inhuman passion precisely because he owed him.
"Shut it and get soldiering,"
Rawn snorted to Bragg. Already there were noises from the side tunnels, and fresh Zoikan forces were firing on them. The main strike force had moved up by then. Gilbert swung a party of Bluebloods to the right and cremated a side tunnel with grenades from their under-barrel launchers. McVenna hurried right with 4 Tanith and a number of scratches, moving to secure their advance from enemy prosecution. A las round hit him in the arm and spun him to the deck. Domor, right behind him, knelt over the injured scout and sprayed las fire down at the hidden shooter, calling for a medic. Beside him, Vinya, one of the loom girls, rebounded off the wall as a brace of las shots caught her in the belly. Several troopers pushed past Domor to hold the side tunnel, flaying las fire down into the dark. Geron joined Domor, running low, holding a las pistol in one hand, the other hand curled around the Narthesium kit to stop it jolting.
"It's McVanner," Domor began.
The medic dropped to his knees beside the scout. The las shot had exploded McVenna's left elbow and disintegrated his biceps. He was curled up, crying with pain, but he forced his voice to work.
"Her first! Her!" he said,
nodding over at Vinya.
Let me look at it, McVenna,
Garen said.
No, you know Fifth in triage. Serious cases first. She's gutshot. See to her.
Give him this, Garen told Domo, handing him a gauze-packed inoculator full of high-dose painkillers. He scrambled over to the sprawled scratch soldier. She was twisted like a broken puppet, her chin forced into her chest where she lay, with the back of her head against the wall. Blood oozed out of her in a wide pool. The wound itself had self-cauterized in charred, knotty lumps, but the damage had shredded her insides, and she was bleeding out rapidly.
Oh, Feth,
Garen spat.
Someone give me a hand here.
Colia was beside him.
Tell me how.
Pressure here and here. Hold it tight. No, tight like you mean it.
They were both sodden with her blood. She stirred, moaning.
Vinya, it's okay. Stay awake,
Colia murmured to her, his hands clamping hard on her ruined organs. He looked around at Garen as he worked frantically.
She's not going to make it, is she?
Major trauma, Garen explained as he worked. I can stabilize her, but no, it's just a matter of time.
Colia nodded. He let go and leaned down to whisper in her ear.
You fought well, Vinya Trigo, of Hab 45JAD. Mervyn Hive will never forget your courage. The Hive loves you for your devotion.
Then he reached down with huge, gentle hands and snapped her neck.
Oh, God, Emperor!
Garen cried, recoiling in horror.
There is a man you can save,
Colia said, pointing at McVenna with a bloody hand.
I love my people, and I will fight for them with every last measure of my strength. But this would have uselessly wasted the time of a good medic when there are better causes. Her pain is over. She has found peace.
Garen wiped his mouth.
I,
he began.
If you are going to tell me you couldn't begin to understand what we Habbers have gone through to get here, save it. I don't want your pity.
Actually, friend, I was going to tell you I do understand, and admire your courage to boot. Our lives are all on the line fighting for your home.
Me, I don't have a home anymore. So Feth, you, and that also noble crap.
Garen gathered his kit pack and moved over to McVenna. Colia picked up his lasgun and strode past, rejoining the fight. Kokoa, Nescon, and Flynn had made it to the corner of the right-hand side access, and they drove the gathering Zoikans backwards. Gaunt, with Genks and Maroi, crawled up behind them.
Access?
Asked Gaunt.
Not a fething hope, sir,
sang out Kokoa. The air was flickering with Laz crossfire.
Bloody bastard hell!
Nescon cried as his gun jammed. He shook it. Gaunt grabbed him and yanked him down into cover just as laser blasts pummeled the wall above his head.
Never forget the drill, Nescon. Gun jams, duck and cover. Don't stand there playing with it.
No, Colonel Commissar.
I like you better alive.
Me too, sir.
Rilke, reckoned to be the best sniper in the Ghosts after Larkin, and the scratch woman Nessa moved up to flank them. Rilke wasted two shots trying to hit a Zoikan in cover down the tunnel. Nessa, with her standard-issue lasgun, picked him off, and the Zoikan behind him.
Where do you learn to shoot like that?
Rilke protested, but she didn't hear him. She couldn't hear him. Gaunt looked across at her, waiting until she saw his face.
Good,
he said. She grinned. A ceiling panel 10 meters back slammed open, and Zoikan stormtroops began to drop down out of it like grains of sand through the neck of an hourglass. They sprayed shots in both directions. 4 ghosts, 2 scratches, and a blue blood went down. Bragg wheeled and decimated the spilling Zoikans, his withering autocannon, supported by Haller, Rawn, Genks, and a dozen others. The Zoikan dead lay in a heap under the ceiling drop. Bragg raised his muzzle and began to fire up into the roof, his heavy rounds punching smooth-edged holes through the sheet metal. Blood began to drip down through some of them.
We're bottled in,
McCall yelled at Gaunt. Gaunt knew as much. Gilbert had blocked the left-hand access, but the right was still thick with Zoikans. And now they were coming down through the ceiling for Feth's sake. At this rate, his strike carder would exhaust themselves simply maintaining a perimeter. If they were going to do anything of note, they had to focus. McCall? Gaunt called. McCall knew what was being asked of him. Gaunt had always valued the chief scout's unerring ability to find the right way. It wasn't a gift, really. Somehow, sometime back in the shifting, drifting forest ways of Tanith, he had come to understand the logic of structure, the underlying sense of any environment. McCall's gut said straight ahead and down.
Through the blast shield, sir,
McCall announced. That was good enough for Gaunt. He crawled back, under heavy fire, to the shields.
Rawn, tube charges here.
"What are you doing?"
bellowed Gilbert, moving up.
"That way will lead us off into the right-hand side of the structure."
Gaunt looked at Gilbert, las shots whizzing around them. "After all we've seen, Gilbert, do you trust me?"
"Very probably, but
if you were constructing this spike, would you put the main command deck in the dead center where anyone would expect it to be?" Gilbert thought for a moment and shook his head. "Then humor me. I've learned to go with McColl's instincts. If I'm wrong, I'll stand you a case of wine. You can choose the vintage."
"If you're wrong, we'll be dead."
"Why do you think I made the bet?" Gilbert laughed out loud.
"Cover and clear!"
yelled Rawn, hastening from the bundle of tube charges he had glued to the shield hatch. The channeled blast tore the doors inwards like paper. Whatever else you could say about him, Rawn knew explosives. There was barely a shockwave on the Imperial side of the hatch.
"For Tanith!"
yelled Gaunt, hurling himself through the opening.
"For Volpone!"
bawled Gilbert, right beside him.
"For Vervenhive,"
mouthed Nessa to herself, close on their heels. Guild Githran Agricultural had fallen. Korbak drove his Tanith back towards the base of the main spine, with all hell following. Milo and Baffles guided their survivor company out of the ruins, chased by Zoikan tank groups. Bray's mixed units wilted in retreat as divisions of Zoikan stormtroopers drove up into the inner habs. The shield pylon shuddered as it took shell after shell. At Crow Gate, Grisman's valiant counteraction finally reached a stop. Flat crabs and spider death machines lumbered in at them. In strength, even the Crusade's finest tank regiment could not withstand. On the dock causeway, Varl and Rodian began to pull their infantry back, facing an ochre host 10,000 strong. Along the edge of the Commercia, where one of the war's bloodiest battles had been waged, Bulwer ordered his North Col and Scratch companies to retreat. Overhead, the shield flickered and waned. It would not last much longer. In the middle of a horrendous brawl in a side trench, Sorek hammered his axe rake into the foe. He was one of the last to heed Bulwer's retreat order. Corday's Volpone unit was pincered by Zoikan detachments. The Blue Bloods were slaughtered by crossfire in the rubble wastes that had once been the inner sector habs. Corday died with his men. In a lost pocket in the wastelands, Kafran held Tona Creed tight, Yonsi and Dalin curled between them. The sky was on fire, and shells fell all around. It was just a matter of time, Kafran knew. But until then, he would hold her and the children as tight as he could. In the baptistry, Bandaur set aside his headset and sat back in his seat. The workers and staff servitors were still milling around, trying to maintain some semblance of control. It was over. Dower got up and crossed to Ott at the font. Windows blew in down the hall, and the main spine shuddered as shells struck it.
"We gave it our best,"
Dower said.
"For Vervenhive,"
Ott agreed, weeping quietly with fatigue. Intendant Bainfail joined them.
"High Legislator Anofi has just been carried out.
A heart attack."
"Then he's been spared,"
Dower said callously. Ott looked at him reprovingly, but Bainfail seemed to agree.
"This is the end, my brave friends. The Emperor love you for your efforts, but this is the end of all things. Vervenhive is lost. Make your peace."
Dower looked round at Immaculus. The minister stood nearby with his robed clergy.
"Begin the mass, sir,"
Dower told him.
"The requiem. I want the last sound I hear to be a psalm of loss voiced by the Emperor's own."
Immaculus nodded. He led his brethren into the celebratory, and the soft dirge, a haunting melody, began to lift above the baptistry and the high stations of Vervenhive. In the abandoned hall of her house, high in the spine, Merity Chas heard the low plain song welling through the halls. She had put on a long formal gown and her father's ducal chain and signet ring, which Dower had brought to her. She had spent an hour putting the House Chas ledgers in order and encrypting all the family documents onto storage crystals. At the sound of the mass, she frowned.
"Not yet, not yet,"
she murmured.
"He won't fail us."